I mean, this was the main argument. This is one that cropped up all through the 19th century, that the belief of the theorists on the subject, that you want to bring the workers in, make them feel they're citizens like everybody else, and one of the ways is to make them pay taxes, even if it's a costly thing to do. The only other factor that operated in PAYE was that for various reasons it is simpler for the Inland Revenue people to collect a lot of small sums of money by having it deducted by the employer. So the argument that was used against it in the Crimean War, that it would be too costly, is no longer so true as it used to be. It's cheaper for the Inland Revenue people to collect it in the present method than it would have been in the 19th century.
When did you think that, though?
PAYE, 1940 or thereabouts. And by the way, the scheme was devised for the government by a trade union, the Inland Revenue Staff Federation.
Yes, what I've got to say, going to sea, it was always on our account of wages, 35 pence in the pound, marked income tax. One time was 20 pence in the pound. I noticed all the seamen, they used to say it was a lot of burden, and it was too. And when you come to a capitalist getting taxed, they could afford it, but we couldn't. Now, I'll put it this way. If it was so for a capitalist, it wouldn't work out that way. 97.5 pence in the pound, the government, and he has £1 million coming in a year. That's £975,000 the government would take. But only 2.5 pence the pound, the capitalist would be left with £25,000 a year take home. And I say that's more money than he can spend. Doesn't work out that way.
The point about the workers being brought into the state and made to identify, I don't think this can be seen too much as a kind of a conspiracy thing, though, because it's the working class, as you pointed out, the civil service union devised this scheme, and terms like no taxation without representation, and also workers saying, talking about paying taxes and providing for the state. This has been a demand of the labour movement. It's never, as far as I'm concerned, been one that's been thrown down from government.
Well, only in the case of the Crimean War, and on that occasion, it was some irritated capitalist politicians. They said that the workers were taking an interest in the war, and they sort of said in irritation, if they want to be interested in the war, let them pay for it. So they then said, bring them into taxation, but the employers didn't want it. Well, I don't know what you've got in mind in particular, but from time to time, the distribution of wages, as it were, though it's not really, it's a rather misleading term to use, what happens from time to time is that some workers at some time do better, and at other times other workers do better. Now, you've got a campaign on now. You've got the Tories, a lot of Tory MPs, and a lot of other workers saying, look, the civil service are doing better, the civil service are getting paid more than other workers. Well, go back 10, 15 years, you had the civil servants saying, we've fallen behind, which was equally true. The people who did best during and after the war were the factory workers. And the people in the service industries, civil service, local authorities, railways, buses, post office, did then comparatively badly. And then you get it reversed. And the same thing happened between the wars. When prices were falling from 1920 to 1930 and thereabouts, merely because of the actual mechanism by fixing civil service and post office wages, post office and civil service wages didn't fall as much as outside worker wages did, like the textile workers sometimes fifth or more of them out of work, and the steel workers and all the rest of it, their wages came down with a run. And they then said, look, the civil service and the post office are doing better than us, their wages haven't come down as much as ours. And the May, or the Geddes Committee, was set up to look into it, and they actually imposed reductions on government staff to bring the workers down to the position of the factory workers. No, I would say that the spread of wages in lots of industries is much wider than it was when conditions were more stable. See, if you've got a long period of time when prices don't change much, or even when they're falling, you, I think it's probably true, I wouldn't like to give the reason, but I mean, I think it is true as a fact, that the spread of wages is not nearly so great as it is now. If you look at the inquiries that are made from time to time, I think it was one in 1970, you'll get an average pay. I mean, some would say, look, the average pay in engineering is £60, somewhere about £60 a week, and you'll get an enormous range of it. I remember at one time, somebody made a special inquiry into engineering pay in Coventry, and they said they found that pay of engineers in Coventry was double or treble what it was in some of the smaller towns in different parts of the country, in spite of the fact that on the face of it the engineers had a national rate of pay. But now, of course, Coventry is in real trouble. All their very, very high rates of pay have come down the rump. I mean, concede that in doing some rounding up and down, wherever they could, they worked against the workers. I don't think you can explain the fact that prices now are 14 times what they were in 1938 and say this is all due to decimalisation. So the new ones are 2.4 times the old one. But I mean, this only operates when they're actually changing over. But you see, before Britain went into the European common market, the price level was already about 10 times what it was in 1938. That had nothing to do with decimalisation. And of course, where you're dealing with average figures about average pay and average price level, this doesn't really enter into it. I mean, you're dealing with whole pounds and fractions of pounds. But I mean, I know what you're arguing, the sort of thing you get in phone-in programs on various radio programs of people saying, look, they changed it over and instead of rounding it to the nearest point downwards, they rounded it to a higher point upwards. Well, right, that's part of the business. But now again, the thing I referred to in the Sunday Times today, the price is coming down very, very rapidly due to the fierce competition of stores. Is it decimalisation is going to save them? They're going to reduce prices.
Well, you said about the part about the reserves on the young employees. That was one way of getting them, and also from other industries, but also they would bring them from other things as well, wouldn't they?
They've done this, yes. That also, you see, from their point of view, is a reserve army. They call on it when they want it, and as Marx pointed out, having called on it when they want it, then the depression comes and they suddenly say, look, we've got too many people here. And as you know, a lot of European countries in the present depression are trying to get rid of their guest workers, send them home again. Not much comment on there, but I do remember, of course, one of the examples of you're not having to push these things too far. Theoretically, as economists used to say, if you've got a completely free market, then wages find their own level. But in fact, if you look at the pay of different grades of workers in different parts of the country, you'll find that a lot of them, I mean, I know one of them that I had to look into on one occasion was the pay of factory cleaners. You might say, you know, so to be all factory cleaners, pretty much the same sort of work. If you had conditions of a free market, cleaners would find a level of pay for themselves, but in fact there are enormous differences. And it often depended partly on where they worked, secondly on the size of the firm, thirdly on the kind of grading in the firm. You've got some very big firms where they had only a few grades, and they would shove factory cleaners on with some other low-paid grades, but in fact it meant very high pay for the cleaners. So you don't get these things working themselves out, you know, to a fine point.
Now, what I've got to say about guest workers going home, there'd be a lot of, same as in England, there'd be a lot of Turkish people there, there'd be a lot now would be Germans of like Turkish descent. They can't send them home. They're not guest workers anymore. They've grown up people again.
One thing to remember about this argument that Chamberlain was using in 1904 and that the Labour Party, or some of it, and the trade unions are using now, that if the government kept out Japanese cars and Hong Kong textiles and foreign steel and so on, it would make jobs for English workers. It's always worth remembering, of course, even on their own argument, if it did, it would only mean by putting some workers out of work in Hong Kong and Germany and Japan. And when that happened, of course, the workers here wouldn't escape the consequences of it, because it would have a depressing effect on, it would have some effect on the Japanese manufacturers and the Hong Kong manufacturers, who would then try to meet these new situations by still further reducing the prices at which they sell them.
Yes.
Then, going to big capital, I think a small passage for natural services secondary exploitation. And it's interesting to connect with the topic where he says that the working class capital is being exploited at point of production, can be exploited over and above that by people like shopkeepers. And in relation to the taxation, could there be a case of saying that in the short term workers actually do pay taxes? Some of the costs are possible, but over the long term, in fact, when labour power equals itself out, then, in the long term, we don't actually do taxes, but in the short term, it could be limited.
Well, that was the point I referred to. I said, you mustn't push it too far, because there's always a period of adjustment, because equally, it could work the other way. Yeah. I mean, in other words, there'd be some workers who might gain in the short period of adjustments, and other workers lose. But also on this, what is called secondary exploitation, which was an unfortunate term for Marx to use, what he meant was, so to speak, the workers can, after having got their wage, they can be swindled in various ways. This is a point Engels deals with, and very, very well, in the housing question, where Engels points out that if there does arise in some neighbourhood a particular form of swindling of the workers of this kind, as soon as it becomes sufficiently widespread, this becomes a factor in the workers' wage itself. In other words, wages will adjust themselves to it. The being swindled will become part of the cost of living of the working class.
It's difficult to comprehend
adjustment
here.
I know it is. I mean, it's not so difficult now as it used to be. You see, wage claims now, so to speak, are continuous. And there was a time when a wage would remain stable in an industry for years and years and years. In other words, there wasn't any opportunity for doing it, and whatever adjustment took place in those cases would take place by, say, employers who didn't pay trade union wages, or alternative employers who had to pay more than trade union wages. And of course, there are now lots of industries in which the printing industry and the engineering industry, though the engineering industry is not so true as it was, where whatever the national wage was, hardly anybody got it. And I suppose it's still true that most printing workers, don't know what the agreement is, under their local agreements, they get a different rate of pay. But conversely, in a period of depression, whatever the agreements may say, you will get masses of employers who don't pay the rate. As between the wars, the agricultural workers' minimum wage, when half the employers were not paying it. The question facing the worker is, do I ask for go to the authorities and say I'm not getting the minimum wage when I lose my job and get chucked out of my cottage? Oh, no, but he wasn't talking about that sort of swindle. He was talking about actual swindle. I mean, selling you bogus stuff and things like this. And the thing was that if it becomes sufficiently widespread practice for various, what do they call them, cowboys nowadays, to swindle you by, selling you stuff which is completely useless or something like this, this becomes part of the workers' cost of doing.
Can
it largely arrive out of the fact that in the factory owners had their own shops, miners, mining areas had their own shops, government shops, and stuff that was sold at inferior, very high prices, was the reason for truck-out.
So then, of course, actually, what Engels was dealing with there in the main was the actual swindling by landlords. And, of course, he dealt with the converse argument, that if so, the cooperative movement manages to lower the workers' cost of living, in the long run, it'll affect wages and put them down.
But if workers in the public sector are getting paid out of taxes, Nalgo have recently had a campaign opposing cuts in public expenditure. As a trade union, I can see some point in them wanting to oppose a government committed to reducing taxation and therefore reducing also expenditure on the kind of services they're involved in, from the point of view of protecting jobs and increasing the value of labour power.
Well, you're thinking of Nalgo in their case, or you can take any other. Yeah. See, what you've got to remember is we're talking about the working class. We're not talking about Nalgo. Now, one of Nalgo's proposals was that the government should spend $1,000 million more on the health service by cutting $1,000 million a year off armament expenditure. Yeah. Well, Nalgo never went to the engineering union first and said, look, do you mind losing 100,000 jobs so that we can have them? And I noticed the post office engineering union last week were using the same sort of argument. They were saying the government ought not to reduce expenditure, they ought to increase expenditure on the post office by developing the telephone service. Well, they haven't asked Confederation COSY about nurses. The nurses were saying, look, we don't want to develop telephone service, we want to develop hospitals. But of course, the basic weakness of all of this argument is it's done from a purely trade union point of view. I mean, each section of trade union, and if Nalgo come along as they did and said the government should spend an additional $7,000 million a year, they have to say where the money is going to come from. Now, if the money, there's only two ways the money can come. Either the government raises it in taxation, in other words, it takes it away from that large body of people called the taxpayer and gives it to industries that Nalgo is interested in, or it borrows from investors, in which case what the government spends more, the taxpayers and the investors spend less. So look at it from the entire working class point of view. It doesn't make any difference to the entire working class. It doesn't make any difference to the working class. If Nalgo gets $2,000 million spent on their things they're interested in, like the health service, and the engineering workers don't get it and lose it and lose their jobs, from the working class point of view, it doesn't make any difference. And of course, the only third way the government can get money, not that you can expect Nalgo to understand this, is they can print it. And if they print it, prices go up, and then, so to speak, superficially, everybody pays for Nalgo's additional jobs.
Well, that's true from the working class point of view, but, I mean, for instance, if you take Ford workers, they had, in 1979, they had a pay claim, and there was a 5% income policy. Now, from a trade union point of view, they were quite right to go for beyond the 5%. And reject what their trade union leaders and the Labour Party were telling them. So they were correct to do that. Now, from a Nalgo point of view, you can't say, well, the Ford workers had that particular trade union objective. Nalgo has a particular trade union objective, so do the engineers. Now, these may all be conflicting things, but what I, you know, would like to establish is that from a trade union point of view, the campaigns against reductions in public expenditure in their particular areas are the only thing that they can do in order to defend themselves. I mean, bar taking political action, which is a trade union, they can't do in isolation. So in other words, what advice can we give or what action can Nalgo take outside of a socialist conscious working class than opposing cuts in public expenditure? And if that is the only action they can take, contradictory and opposed to other sections of the working class as it may be, and in many senses increases in pay for the Ford workers could have the same effect on other sections of the working class, why not?
Well, I mean, what are you going to do for the working class?
Not for the Nalgo workers.
No, but then, right, then you see, you are in this position of Nalgo saying, look, we couldn't care less about 100,000 engineers losing their job. We want the government to spend less on armaments and spend it on the health service so that we can have jobs.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is friction between the working class and simply doesn't get them anywhere.
Yeah, well, what advice, other than that, what else can Nalgo do except take reductions in people working in the public sector. You know, and also, as the government has recently said, taking wage decreases for people working in the public sector. Now, as a trade union, they've got an obligation to try to defend, first of all, to defend jobs, but more important, to defend the particular people in work.
Well, yes, yeah, but see, what you're saying is that NALGO as a union has an interest in defending NALGO as a union.
Nothing
to do with the working on. Well, right, they can try and use action to prevent wages coming down, or even within the terms of what the government is prepared to offer them, what the government has said to them, look, there's a cash limit on all this. If you want higher pay, it's going to be at the expense of reduction in your number of staff. Now, of course, no union wants its membership to be reduced. I saw a statement by an official of the National Graphical the other day at their conference, where he said that in all that fight in the Times, they were fighting for the survival of their union. Not, you see, fighting for the working class, or not even, so to speak, fighting for the wages of the people who might survive in it, but simply fighting for the survival of their union, which is, I mean, from a point of view of union officials, is a very natural thing. But, I mean, from a socialist point of view, of course, they should interest themselves in socialism. And from a working class point of view, the workers should take a working class position. You see, if you don't do this, you get this situation where workers in a British industry will say, let's put some Japanese workers out of work, provided for a little time we can keep our own jobs. Well, it's absolutely fatal for the working class. And incidentally, the SPGB, long, long ago, when I think it was the Canadian organisation, opposing the influx of either Chinese or Japanese workers, the SPGB condemned them for it and said, look, you've got to take a working class point of view. If you once abandon a working class point of view, there is simply nothing you won't do. See, if you once abandon the working class point of view and say, look, from the point of view of a limited number of workers in a particular industry, anything that protects their position is worthwhile, okay. Then you get what you had after all. You get the bus workers saying we won't have women drivers from their point of view, and the male teacher saying we don't want women teachers. See, on a short-sighted point of view, it's all very good argument. Incidentally, the post office workers saying we don't want women postmen. And back, was it 10, 20 years ago, the miners saying we won't have Italian miners working in the mines.
I've heard of that.
I mean, if you once adopt this point of view, then gone is any chance of working class unity. Well, I've got a simple comment on this. If you tell the workers they don't pay taxes, you're in trouble.
Well,
I didn't say the workers don't pay taxes. The SS article didn't say the workers don't pay taxes. They said taxes are a burden on the wealth of the property class. Well, but if you tell the workers they don't pay taxes...
It went in, the whole convenience and handiness of it, instead of the employer directly giving to the government the same funds that we used for the employment that you for a week, that was his capital, you were the lady on his capital, on your head, the capital. He might judge it, he's the way to sort of cheating, you know, backsliding on government debt, and the founder, by putting it into the employee's wage package, that was the way to live, that was the way to see. You see, I've heard people say to me again when I face them at the trip, you don't pay taxes, you don't pay a penny tax regardless.
No, but you shouldn't say that, make that statement, because it's so blatantly untrue and impossible to prove.
Because you see, to come back with the idea, you've got to tell me that I don't pay insurance, money for insurance.
I'm not going to tell you anything of the kind.
I've lived with a hospital contribution that in our world. You're telling me I don't pay for that. I don't pay for my superannuation.
See, as Marx did, and the Fitzgerald article, and I mean, well, I suppose always it's in, you've got to put it the other way around. You've got to say, is it possible for the capitalist class, who has got to pay a certain level of wages for the workers, then, because they pay tax, to say, well, we've got to pay them £80, but we're going to pay them £70. I mean, they can't do it. The capitalists always pay the workers only what they must pay the workers. And the burden of administering capitalism falls on the capitalist class, and they know it too, or they do.
You better go and find those people, colleagues.
Well, yes,
we'll
see about that.
On the question of trade union activity being moving away from the question of protecting jobs themselves to find funding for spending the government cuts and expenses on the question of straightforward pay rates within a certain industry, didn't Marx show that that in fact had no bearing on the pay in other areas? In other words, they believe that we can make a direct pay rate in one industry, trying to find some sort of wages there, and it needs in any way be divided into far as it's not actually necessarily making things work for workers in other areas. But would you say that's the one area where trade union actions can be legitimately carried out without being divided?
Well, I would say that you're in a rather difficulty here. You see, it's obviously crazy that there should be over 500 trade unions standing on each other's toes. What is it, 38 unions in the motor industry? I mean, it's obviously crazy. But, I mean, accepting this situation, all you can say is that, I mean, it's rather difficult. Each union should get what it can, that's all. And if the Ford Motor people can get more, then the Ford Motor people get more. And not listen to some other trade unions who say to them, look, if you've got less, we get more, which, I mean, it just isn't true. There is no practical way in which the increase of pay that workers get in Ford because they happen to be making high profit, or the high pay that oil workers are getting at the present time, is going to adversely affect other workers. On the contrary, for what it's worth, and isn't much, when workers see a certain rate of increase going in some other industry, it may encourage them to try to do the same for themselves, but they won't succeed. I mean, if the money isn't there, they won't get it.
Yes, but it does in the public sector, and I think it's sort of unfair, apart from anything else, and unrealistic to expect workers in the public sector not to take, not to expect to try to defend jobs and try to get higher wages on the ground that this is going to affect workers in other areas of the public sector. When this doesn't happen in private industry.
Well, the same argument is used in private industry, all right. I mean, in the case of Ford, when Leyland actually pointed out that we can't afford to get the increase that Ford can get, and Chrysler said the same. So, as far as the argument is concerned, it's there. But, you see, this is an aspect of capitalism. Workers in an industry can legitimately try to get as much as they can. But from time to time, they run into a problem which arose back in the 19 between the wars anyway, in the mining industry. At a certain stage, there were over 1 million miners, and the man who was Smith of the Mine Owners Federation went to the Federation of Miners and said, look, it's as simple as this. You can have 1 million miners at £2 a week, or you can have 700,000 miners at £2.50 a week. You can't have both. Because if we have to pay £2.50, a fifth of the mines, the companies will go bust. Well, I mean, I remember I put this question to Fitzgerald, wrote this article, and said, what would you do? And he said, well, of course, it's a very difficult question. But he said his own view was the workers should press for the higher pay and not the jobs. Because he said, once you give way on pay, you'll find it very, very difficult to get it back again. So it's best the Miners' Federation should have done, I mean, his view, was to say, all right, we'll go for the £2.50, and we'll have to put up with the closing down of mines. Yeah.
But why, from the trade union point of view, shouldn't they go for both?
Because they won't get both.
They won't get both on the grounds that it's, you know, not the political interest of a trade union to try to tell the government how much taxation to raise and how to spend its money. But as a trade union, I would see that was their particular economic interest at that time, to try to tell the government how much taxation to raise and how to spend its money.
Yeah, but you see, wait a minute. Nalgo are in the same position as the other government unions. The government has said to them, there is a cash limit. And in other words, a certain global amount of money you're going to get. If you have higher pay, there'll be fewer of you. If there are more of you, you won't get the higher pay. And I mean, the government's in a position to dictate it, and the government could do it. But just incidentally, Nalgo are only putting half the picture. When Nalgo said we object to the government running a policy of cutting government expenditure, at the back of their minds, what they are saying to the government and what the TUC is saying to the government, we want you to go back to the old Keynesian rubbish. Well, from our point of view, neither the new Milton Friedman rubbish nor the old Keynesian rubbish are any good to the working class, that's all.
Could you comment on that point on the equalisation of
the sector? What was
that? Taxation was equalised out of the conflict for the gap through the fact that the employed women units are
productive. Well, I mean, I don't accept the argument at all, you see. I mean, see, because it starts on the assumption of saying that the workers don't pay taxes. Well, the argument should never be put in, I mean, I would say the argument should never be put in this way, because obviously a worker who's had PAYE deducted, well, it's no use saying to him, look, you haven't had it deducted, you said, I've paid it. What you say is, from a working class point of view, the capitalists cannot pass on the burden of taxation to the working class, because the working class...
No, that's how the tax burden itself amongst the capitalists,
what
are
they competing? Oh, they're competing with each other, oh yes. I mean, in other words, they're all trying to pass the buck to somebody else. See, reluctantly, the oil industry have accepted this increase of the oil tax. The banks were able to dissuade the government from putting an extra tax on the banks. But the whole system of taxation in this country, and I suppose in other countries, what happens is that when some industry is making super profits, the government steps in and creams them off, as they did with the entertainment tax. And when there came a time when the receipts from the entertainment tax were really not worth collecting, and the government scrapped it. If the entertainment industry moved into a situation again where they were booming, as of course they were booming during the war, the government will reimpose the tax. Whatever industry is making extra profit, the government will step in and take it. And the employers in that industry will try to prevent it. I mean, like the brewers will always try to pass the buck to the tobacco people, or the tobacco people will try to pass it to somebody else.
Really limited to any conversation, but I'm going to call the state to, in fact, increase the amount that it receives in full taxable customer profit. So therefore there isn't a cash limit. Even in the public sector wage claims, it needn't be...
I'm not quite sure that I follow you about this. If you say there's no limit, look, if the working class got an increase of pay of 20%, the whole of the profit of companies and national identities would disappear. I was looking at Courtauld's account. If Courtauld's staff got an 18% increase of pay, the whole of Courtauld's profit would disappear.
I see, sorry, yes, I didn't mean that, there's a limit, but I mean, when the government says there's a cash limit.
Oh, no, this is an arbitrary one. They're imposing. They're saying to the civil service, we have fixed a cash limit.
A cash limit is supposed to take it was introduced in relation to inflation, wasn't it? It's supposed to predict the amount of money that for the expenditure for a particular section of the public sector, taking into account the increase in inflation over the next year. And invariably, the cash limits have been lower than increases in inflation over the next year. And I think this is the point, you're making the same one as me, that Nalgo has got an interest in saying to the government the cash limits should be higher than anything. Or, as many of the trade unions have been saying, abolish cash limits in terms of... Well, there may be, but, the solution is to abolish the wages system. But given a situation where that doesn't happen, we're talking about what is the most effective trade union action.
Yeah, but then, see, you're not saying... I mean, you haven't gone into the question of what's effective. You can say they can argue. But if the government say to the civil service, we have fixed a cash limit, that is to say, I don't know what the figure is, we'll allow you to spend 14% more this year than last, and within that limit you can negotiate pay increases, it's a simply arithmetic proposition that if the pay goes up more than 14%, the number of jobs goes down. And I mean, you may say that it's quite legitimate for the each union to argue against this, but you see, even this person doesn't defend Nalgo, because Nalgo haven't stuck to their own field and said, look, in the field of local government, this is what we're doing. They've said, take away 100,000 jobs from the engineering industry so that we can have more jobs here.
What I've got to say, because I'm not referring to Britain, but Bologna, where certain times in the morning, transport is free, of course, to take workers to work, and certain time at night to bring them home. That's been before arbitration or anything where they freshen out the wage pay. Would that be taken in account to lower the wages?
Well, what do you think the employers will say about it?
They
I mean, take my example of the civil service London waiting, which is the one of the major factors is the cost of travel inside London. Next time they go to the civil service department, if there is free transport in London, they say, well, look, we knock it off.
Oh, yeah. Oh
well, I mean, as far as workers' savings are concerned, I would say, go back 5 or 6 years, workers' savings had increased, but you see what's happening in the Depression, as always in the Depression, they're all disappearing again. I mean, the workers are losing what they gained in that respect. But this isn't the same as the question of the movement of wages. And on all the available inference, the wage index, the earnings figures, and the total wages bill of the whole working class, all of them have increased very considerably more than the average increase in prices. Since 1938, which is what you'd expect. I mean, in the 19th century, real wages were increasing something like 1% a year, and they'd probably have gone on increasing about 1% a year since 1938. They fell back in the Depression of 75 to 77. They're falling back now, and when trade revives, they'll resume their small upward course again. Actually, it's very much the same. In the last 20 years, the average increase in GNP per head, in real terms, per head of the population, actually, is 2.25% a year.
It's still bigger than the 1%.
Yes, but the workers don't get a hold of this,
no.
You see.
Yeah.
And, I mean, neither, in a sense, do the capitalists. A lot of it, you see, has gone to building up roads and bridges and hospitals and things like this. There is one way in which they have been able to control, not by income tax, but by children's allowances. See, this was, for a very real reason, this did bring about some sort of change of forces inside the working class, because when they gave children's allowances to workers and families, they were able to divide the unmarried workers, men and women, from the married ones. The married ones would say, well, look, at a particular moment, we don't want to go on strike, we're getting children's allowances now, we're a bit better off. And so you get a division of opinion among the workers. I'm not saying it was done for that reason, although Eleanor Rathbone, who advocated it, she had that sort of thing in mind.
Okay, are there any final points? Does anybody wish?
Well, I think Comrade Coleman's point, I don't think he'd disagree with you. You see, in private industry, if the workers will not work at a wage which will enable the worker to make a profit, the profit of the firm goes out of business. Workers haven't got the job. I mean, it's perfectly clear. And it's happened in the nationalised industries, in the steel industry, and it will happen in a little way in the mining industry. In other words, pits that don't pay will be closed down. But what Comrade Coleman was trying to argue is that it can be different in the industries like the one Nalgo operates. But I think that they're up against the fact that the government's the government, and if the government says, you know, that's what we will spend on you, right, the union can try to argue about it. But one last thing. This question I put to you, at least the statement I made to you about the miners back in the 20s, when the mine owners said, you know, you can have 1 million jobs at £2 a week or 700,000 jobs at £2.50, what do you think about it? I mean, that was Fitzgerald's answer. He said, you know, I think the union is a very difficult thing, but they'd better stick to the money, not the job. Yeah, of course, from the union's own point of view, the union as an organisation wants the job.
Any further comments, contributions, or questions? Tony, is all this
like,
Well, that's right. I mean, what they can do for the workers, they can do when capitalist conditions make it possible. When capitalism is booming, the unions can do something for the working class as a whole, or practically all of them. When capitalism is in the depression, as Marx used the phrase, the workers can test the situation. In other words, they should try it out, because the employers may be going a bit further than in fact the employers intend to go, and the workers are tried out, but obviously there is a limit to what they can do.
Yes, what I've got to say, you take on seafaring. The Americans, just after the war, are pushing their wages up and up and up. Well, they were strong, all right, but all of a sudden they just slung them under the flag of convenience, because they thinking themselves of the big boys.
Of course, you do remind me of the case of the National Union of Seamen in this country. I don't know whether it's still there, but 3 or 4 years ago, the National Union of Seamen in this country made an agreement with the employers that they would not press for the coloured seamen to have the same pay as the white seamen, and the employers paid them, was it about 300,000 quid a year for it? Now, you see, from the white seamen's point of view, they may say this is good trade union practice. From the other point of view, of course, it's appalling.
Well, I don't remember that.
I think they've begun to regret that.
Have they?
Oh. It's not a call that the trade union funds did assess the 300,000.
Not what?
It's not a call that the trade union funds did assess
the... That's right, except 300,000 for the employers on condition they didn't press for higher wages for the coloured seamen.